Hi, this is Bob. Last week on our podcast, we featured an episode of The United States of Anxiety, a series produced by our colleagues in the WNYC newsroom in collaboration with The Nation magazine. This week, the team examines the history of what it means and has meant to be white in the United States of America. For some on Long Island, their expectations don't match their realities, and their dreams have been well and truly deferred.
I always knew 90% of the media were in Clinton's pocket. But now, of course, with WikiLeaks and doing a lot of research on all that, it's quite obvious.
Everything has to be about race with these people. And, we were supposed to be post-racial with the election of Obama.
Media and politicians have a lot of power. When, you have a kids, they listen and listen to the radio or watching the TV. And sometimes they want to take to their own hands. In the case of my brother, that happens.
No matter where you turn, you can't escape this fact. If you are conservative, Republican, straight, and white, you are yesterday. You are so yesterday. You are so irrelevant. You are so unnecessary.
I grew up a racist, and one of the hard things about growing up a racist is first confronting the fact that you are, and then dealing with the people that you love who made you a racist. You know, to me, that's the hardest thing, and people don't talk about that.
God bless the United States of
anxiety.
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 I'm Kai Wright, and this is The United States of Anxiety, a podcast from WNYC Studios and The Nation magazine. This week, I want to first introduce you to a charming young man named Phil Tamburino.
I retired 6 years ago. I'm 66, and my wife just retired last June, so she's a newbie. It took her about 30 seconds to get used to retirement.
If the American dream is dead, somebody needs to tell Phil, because this guy is living the life. After four happy decades as a teacher on Long Island, he stepped aside of his own accord and is now laid up in his gorgeous home on 5 acres in Huntington Station. He gave me and our producer, Joe Capriglione, a tour one afternoon this summer.
This is like, got a lot of memories built into this place. And every tree and every bush and every flower you see, every plant, either I planted or my parents planted.
From this paradise, he presides over a life that's full of family and friends that he's had for decades.
This is my best friend, Ted, also from Corona.
How you doing, Ted?
And Barbara Pafundi.
From the Bronx.
From the Bronx.
Jewish one married into the Italian.
Yeah, that'll happen.
Joe and Kai.
Ted and Phil grew up together in Corona, Queens, in the 50s and 60s, back when the neighborhood was exclusively Italian-American.
I grew up in a four-family house. My grandparents were in one apartment. We were in another apartment. My aunt and uncle were in a different apartment, and a good friend of the family was in the other apartment. And my aunts and uncles lived not too far away. Every Sunday, my grandmother would cook dinner, and there'd be 20 people in the house.
That was their whole life. Italians doing Italian stuff inside the borders of Corona. Phil says they knew nothing of the world beyond that until he left the neighborhood for high school.
So I left the cocoon, and there I met predominantly Irish Catholics from Long Island, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. One of my friends, very seriously, I thought he was kidding at first, said to me, "Is it true that Italians throw their garbage out the window?" He was dead serious. No, that was my reaction. I started laughing. That was his family story about Italians. Italians threw their garbage out the window.
Because the thing is, at the time, Italians, they were still the new immigrants. Along with Poles and Hungarians and others from Southern and Eastern Europe, they were still considered inferior to more Northern white people.
We never thought of ourselves as not white, but people treated us that way.
So how did this change? How'd Phil's family go from being seen as dirty ghetto dwellers to his enviable life today? We will get to that later in the episode. But first, what's all this got to do with the election? From the day Donald Trump announced his candidacy by calling Mexican immigrants rapists, from that moment, race, or more specifically, racism, has been at the center of this election. And in some ways, that's just normal. Race is always part of American politics. But typically, the attention is focused on people of color, and usually on what's wrong with us, what problem we have that needs to be solved. But now, we're in an interesting moment in America. As historian Nell Irvin Painter said in a previous episode, it's one of those rare times when whiteness is the subject of debate.
In the discussions that are going on now about identity that includes the racial identity of white people, and this is something I think is new, discussions of white privilege, for instance, they take a lot of white people quite by surprise.
So far in this podcast, we've been fussing around at the edges of that discussion. But this week, we're going to come right at it. And the first question we've got to ask is basic. What's whiteness?
It's always been really hard to pin down legal definitions of whiteness. Usually, it has to do with not being black or how much black can be in white. So white is kind of this vague, floating concept. But certainly, whiteness can be constricted and be enlarged as people feel the need.
And it has been. Over and over again throughout our history, what it means to be white has morphed and changed legally, culturally, and politically, maybe especially politically, because the political manipulation of racial identity has been a crucial part of our electoral politics from jump.
The United States was one of the first countries in the world that had something close to universal white male suffrage.
This is Joshua Freeman, a history professor at Queens College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. In the early 19th century, one state after another got rid of rules that limited voting to property owners. And Freeman says this created a challenge for political parties that had until then been these exclusive patrician organizations.
You have a new problem. How do you mobilize these people? How do elites and political leaders relate to this new political nation, you know, which is being created for the first time?
The answer? You entertain them. You throw big, raucous parties at which people can break social rules and generally feel free, at a moment when industrialization was rapidly taking away actual free time.
There is a long tradition in American life of elections as entertainment, as a kind of almost festival or carnival-like activity. And you go back to the 19th century, Election Day itself was a day full of parades, entertainment, drinking, brawling, showing off. It was a lot of fun if you sort of like that kind of thing. You know?
If you like to get in the street and be ratty, you know, come vote.
Absolutely.
But these parties were also about creating a certain kind of political identity for voters, one organized around race.
This is the same period where in many places, including New York, black voting is getting restricted. So you're having simultaneously the expansion of white voting to virtually all adult white men and the restriction of black voting. And so maybe this puts in the very DNA of this kind of carnivalesque electioneering a racial element.
These events remained a mainstay of American politics for generations, and their racial DNA remained a part of it as well.
Now, I think the most recent precedent that I could think of was the George Wallace campaign in 1968, when his rallies were big events and tense events. There were often protesters and hecklers involved. They would start with a country and western band that would play Dixie. And this is true, by the way, in the North as well as in the South. It wasn't just
up
in the South.
Up here in New York.
Oh, yeah. In Boston, in New York, they would play Dixie. And then Wallace would get up there and people would boo. And he would like this because he played brilliantly off of hecklers, you know, and pointed to them and kind of denounced them. And, you know, those people with the sandals over there. And, you know, if they sat down in front of my car, I'd run them over.
You could be narrating a Trump rally. I mean, this is his group. He loves the hecklers. He loves to sort of pace off of them.
By the way, in a kind of slightly more restrained way, Richard Nixon did the same thing in 1968. His advance people made sure that there were protesters inside these big rallies.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because they wanted to play off of it.
So there's very little that's new about Donald Trump's much-discussed rallies. They follow a script for events that have long been a staple of American politics. Anytime someone has wanted to rally voters around a white political identity. What's new, though, is the context for these rallies. A time when, as Painter says, the existing definition of whiteness is up for debate.
How do you define white? well, you can look at people's skin color, but that doesn't work because there are a lot of people who are brown but who are white. And the attributes of whiteness in the 20th century, power, wealth, beauty, these are more shared now. So there are people who were brown, people who were black, who were powerful, who are wealthy, and who are beautiful. And actually, with the rise of the drug crisis in the middle of America and rural America, whiteness of a certain class is being rendered ugly.
So what does all this mean in real life? The polls say 35% of Donald Trump's current voters are white men without a college degree, by far Trump's best demographic. The politics website 538 has even created an electoral map based on that polling, and it shows what would happen if only white men voted in the upcoming election. Trump wins in a landslide. So we sent WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady to Suffolk County with a guide, a writer and photographer who has chronicled Trump country for years, even before it had a name.
Chris Arnotti is a former bond trader with a PhD in particle physics. He used to be a quant, a guy who uses higher math to get an edge on the market. You heard about quants if you watched the movie The Big Short.
That's my quant.
Your what?
My quantitative. My math specialist. Look at him.
Arnotti says he couldn't look at himself in good conscience when the economy crashed in 2008.
B's, zero. Double B's, zero. Triple B's, zero. And then that happens.
What is that?
That's America's housing market.
So Arnotti quit his job and moved with his family from their condo in Brooklyn Heights to New Paltz, near some woods with coyotes. He's Catholic, so he's been trying to atone by going to the places in America that his Wall Street math helped wreck. What he's found can be boiled down to a phrase.
There's a sense of economic anxiety and a sense of kind of having been kicked in the balls.
Kicked in the balls. In 2015, he landed a writing assignment from the Atlantic magazine to drive around the country.
Just talking to Americans about the American dream.
He put 20,000 miles on his Honda Odyssey.
Binghamton, New York, Kingsport, Tennessee.
He keeps a mattress in the back so he can car camp in Walmart parking lots. It's a thing. You can Google it.
Floyd County, Kentucky, Buffalo, New York, Selma, Alabama.
Arnotti figured out it's a good idea to put a leather-bound book next to the driver's seat that says, Holy Bible. It has a calming effect on policemen and strangers, especially in the South. He stashes his prized possession, his interview notes, between the pages of the book, because no one ever messes with it.
I think that direction's better.
Okay.
Because
he and I are taking a road trip to the plainer side of Suffolk, the towns you bypass on your way out to the Hamptons.
Now you're getting kind of Jimmy's Diner, you're getting kind of...
Places like Mastic and Shirley and Center Moriches.
Pizza, karate, tanning, drywall.
This looks a little more kind of my territory.
His territory is the large and overlooked middle zones between dynamic downtowns and tourist destinations, places crippled by the recession and pummeled by the changing economy, as he found on his reporting trip.
The first person I talked to was in a small upstate New York town that once had industry, but now the only jobs there now were guiding tourists who came to do trout fishing. They would stock the river. And the guy, I asked him, you know, about the American dream, and his response was, the American dream's broken. I mean, it's gone.
Upstate New York once had factories owned by bedrock firms like IBM and Kodak, Corning and Carrier, a company that this year alone laid off hundreds of workers.
He said, this town used to make things. Now all we do is we cater to tourists who come here to fish our rivers with fish that we don't even have. We put the fish in the river for them to catch.
Arnotti says over and over he's run into a side effect that comes with the switch from blue-collar jobs that take muscle to service jobs that don't. Emasculation.
You know, there's this guy in Prestonburg, Kentucky, who I'll never forget. I was there for a week, and I spent most of my time in the Walmart Plaza. It's a small town, so he saw me all my time. He knew what I was doing. I asked him, you know, about his job, and he kept saying, it's a paycheck. That was it. I don't like it, but it's a paycheck. And that's the attitude. It's, you know, this isn't me. I'm more than this. His grandfather, his father was a coal miner, and he stocked shelves at a supermarket. And he wasn't proud of it, to be honest. I mean,
we're on the Long Island Expressway, not far from Bethpage, home to Northrop Grumman. This is the company that built World War II Hellcat fighter planes and the first lunar module.
Listen, Vanguard Base here. The Eagle has landed.
In the 1980s, Grumman employed as many as 80,000 people. 99% of those jobs are gone. 850 cut as recently as 2 years ago. Grumman no longer builds airplanes on Long Island. An argument is raging right now about whether the deep sense of grievance among Trump voters is legitimate, economic hardship, or illegitimate. Racism, xenophobia, misogyny. Arnotti says all of that mixed together, plus something else. The feeling among a lot of the white working class that they've become targets of mockery, the goofballs in the back row of the classroom.
One of the pernicious, is that a word, pernicious?
It is.
One of the pernicious, that means bad, right?
Do you want to spell it?
The idea is it's a meritocracy that consequently, if you don't make it, it's your fault. You know, you just didn't study hard enough or you're stupid. And that's a phrase that a lot of people, I find extremely offensive, is when they categorize a group of voters as being dumbs or stupid.
Earlier this year, when big-name political writers like Jonathan Chait were calling Trump voters, quote, complete idiots, Arnotti published an essay in The Guardian under the headline, Why Trump Voters Are Not Complete Idiots. We pull off Montauk Highway to stop at one of the area's ubiquitous roadside hot dog stands. This one has a large sign with the image of the flag and the caption, Proud to be an American. Up walks Connie.
Connie Napolitano.
Born in Brooklyn.
Greenpoint section.
Was it good growing up there?
Oh, great. Not today, but when I was there, yeah. I'm out here 46 years.
Where? What town?
Shirley.
Greenpoint used to be great, but not today. Like America. Connie says she and her husband, Fiore, moved to Long Island in 1970 to escape the crime in Brooklyn and raise their seven children, all of them grown now.
They all got houses. They all got good jobs.
So technically, the Napolitanos have achieved the American dream. Still, she worries.
But I'm worried about this presidentship, what's going to happen here.
What's worrying you about it?
I don't like either one of them, but I'd rather see Trump get in rather than Hillary Clinton.
Why is that?
I think he knows more what to do with money and about the war. What does she know about the war? She don't know nothing.
I start to ask about race and immigration, but she cuts me off.
Go talk to my husband in a truck. He'll talk to you better than I will.
Okay. Hey.
How we doing?
She said you have opinions.
Yeah, about this country?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? It's Wait, going for, down the tubes.
It's going down the tubes. Well, why?
Why? Yeah. Look what's happening in this country. First of all the jobs are leaving, number one. Everything is made of plastic, no more metal. And bring back the steel industry. I mean, there's a million things. The kids can't do nothing with their hands no more.
The loss of manual labor is a big deal to Fiore. He's retired after working 40 years as a mechanic.
I was a truck mechanic for one of the largest companies in the world.
In where?
Smith
Freight in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Smith Freight.
No.
Spector.
Spector Freight.
S-P-E-C-T...
You got me.
Spector Freight in Brooklyn.
You got the wrong guy. You hardly write my name, so I got more brains in my little thumb than people. You know, I have no schooling, no education, but I can straighten out this country, I would say, halfway at least.
Fiore doesn't trust Hillary and is no fan of President Obama.
Obama talks for 8 years. He didn't do nothing.
He tells Arnotti and I that he likes Trump.
I want to ask you a question that... Don't take it the wrong way, but
no.
A lot of people say Trump is a racist. What do you think to that?
I think everybody's racist.
You know what? There's good and bad in black. There's good and bad in white. There's good and bad in Hispanic. Nobody's better than anybody else.
I have an old gentleman, old coal miner, and he lost his arm almost and just took the blood from the color guy. A Negro man saved his life. Okay? I have a Puerto Rican friend of mine. He is so close, he's my brother. He's a millionaire, this guy. I've never posed on him, but he would be there for me if I needed it. Now, he's Puerto Rican. And believe me, I'll stand in the way of both of him.
We say goodbye, but Fiore stops us to reveal that while he'll vote for Trump, his ideal candidate is another man.
Well, my candidate, they're going to laugh if I tell you, is John Wayne. Okay, he ain't there no more. Okay, he ain't there no more.
John Wayne, the legendary cowboy actor.
If he ever catch you burning the American flag, you better hope to God he don't kill you.
The Duke. Not a man who guides finance guys to the local trout stream. A man who saves widows in the West and kicks ass on Omaha Beach. A father figure who could retrieve our mythic past.
Face the flag, son, and face reality. Our strength and our freedoms are based in unity. Flag is but a symbol.
Arnotti and I get back in the Honda, and, you know, because we're members of the media elite, we eat knishes with mustard as we drive back to the city. He says Fiore's lament about the changing nature of work is familiar to him from his travels.
The kind of jobs that have been lost, as physically demanding as they were, gave some people a sense of pride. You know, you don't hear a lot of country music songs about people working at the McDonald's or being a greeter at Walmart or stocking shelves at Walmart.
Songs like Alabama's 40-Hour Week.
Hello, Pittsburgh, steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line.
What's driving so much of what's going on is the need for pride, the feeling of being humiliated.
Pittsburgh played a central role in building our nation. But our workers' loyalty was repaid, you know it better than anybody, with total betrayal.
Once somebody feels humiliated, they will do most anything to try to A, get revenge, or B, find a way to get pride back. And I think Trump, he's selling them a scam of cheap pride. This is a cheap way to feel included. This is a cheap way to get back at the world that's wronged you.
Don't worry, we're bringing it all back. Don't worry about it, okay? Don't worry.
With a spirit you can't replace with no machine. Hello, America.
But you know, not all white people in Long Island feel like they've lost something. For some, the American dream is alive and well and has gotten better precisely because it accommodates change. After the break, we go back to Phil Tamburino and the Italian American dream.
But first, we're hearing from you. We're broadcasting every Thursday night on WNYC Radio and taking your calls. Last week, we asked you how often you engage with opposing political viewpoints, and we heard from Mike in Westchester.
You know, I think if we all spend a little bit more time listening to the other side, trying to understand where they're coming from, you know, there is a little bit of middle ground. And I find that when I have a respectful conversation with, you know, whether it's my father-in-law or anyone else coming from the right, we end up agreeing more than we end up disagreeing. We just have to calm down and listen to each other.
What's happening in your community that's making you anxious? Give us a call at 646-783-9692.
I pointed out at the top of the episode that Italian Americans weren't always considered on par with other white people. They got special classification on their immigration documents noting their dark skin. They were barred from a lot of jobs and industries, and they were confined to ghettos like Corona. In some ways, you could say they were the most recent group to be fully admitted into whiteness in America. Fred Gardafay is a distinguished professor of English and Italian American Studies at Queens College. And he remembers the tail end of those days when he was a kid in Chicago in the 60s. And the shame that came with being at the bottom of the social ladder, both here and back in Italy. So much so that when he tried to get in touch with his Italian roots, his family really wasn't into it.
I learn proper Italian. I come back to my grandmother and I start speaking to her Italian. She answers me in English. And I said to my uncle, I said, how come grandma always responds to me in English when I speak to her in Italian? He goes, you really want to know? I said, yeah. He said, she doesn't want to tell you this, but she says, when you speak Italian, you sound like a priest. And I said, what does that mean? She goes, well, you know, she didn't trust the priests in Italy. It's better you speak the dialect that you grew up with her, and don't worry about this Italian, because it reminds her that she didn't have that education.
And she really didn't want to talk about how she was received when she came to the United States.
Because I would ask my grandmother, tell me what it was like coming here. She goes, miseria. She would throw her hand out and she would say, miseria. And that just means misery. And she didn't want to talk about it. And so a lot of what the Italians didn't talk to their kids about, didn't process that discrimination, didn't get passed on.
He says they passed on something else instead. The warning that Italians were already entirely too close to black people. Not just in the racist imagination of other whites, but literally.
And if you look at the lines in the city that divide neighborhoods, the Italians are always in this buffer zone between the blacks and the whites. So, you know, sometimes, you know, they're called in-between people.
And if you're in between, you can go up or you can go down. The way up was clear to anybody paying attention to how America works.
Italian Americans, you know, learned very quickly, the sooner you become white, the sooner you get to benefit by white privilege. And so they tried very hard. I remember my mother saying to me when I was outside playing, don't stay outside. You're going to get dark as a, and she would use the N-word, you know. We have to separate ourselves from them. Otherwise, we'll end up like them. American means white for them. They want to be American.
And then a really big change offered full American status, the suburbs. We've already talked about this back in episode 2. A combination of public and private investment moved white people, all kinds of white people, out of the cities and into the suburbs to create a very particular kind of middle class. Nuclear families, headed by men, and all-white neighborhoods. Italians benefited from this, just like all kinds of other white people benefited from it. Which brings us back to Phil Tamburino, living the dream in his Huntington Station Garden of Eden. Phil and Ted are notably not Trump's kind of white guys. When manufacturing disappeared in Long Island, it didn't upset their lives, because their family stories had in fact followed the narrative of progress that was supposed to define the 20th century.
In my family, I'm the first one to graduate from college.
Yeah, I was the second.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was like unheard of. You know, you went to high school. If you went to high school, you graduated. And you went, you got a most likely a blue-collar job. And to go out, go to college, and to become a white-collar professional was unheard of back in the 60s and 70s.
Those blue-collar jobs were the first step. Historians note that for Italians, Phil and Ted's parents broke the economic barriers, and the next generation broke the cultural barriers. Phil explains how that worked for his family. How his dad got his foot in the door of a job in the city sanitation department, setting them down the path to middle class.
So this was 1939, the World's Fair, which was in Corona. It's funny because when the Italians lived there, they called it the Corona Dumps. After, when they built the World's Fair in 1939, it became Flushing Meadow. So he applied for a job at the fair doing sanitation work and was getting nowhere. So he reapplied under the name, instead of Tamburino, he reapplied under the name Phil Tam, T-A-M-B, and they hired him instantly. You could do that with your name, but you can't do it with your skin color, unfortunately, because, you know, they were not hiring black people for those jobs either. And his claim to fame was that at the World's Fair, he actually cleaned up the horse manure behind Queen Elizabeth's carriage when she visited the World's Fair. It's a great story.
So there you go.
Picked up the... Exactly. Exactly.
Cleaning the Queen's crap. That's how you get ahead in America. But hey, the Tams thrived from there. And when they got enough money together, they bought a piece of land way out on Long Island, on what was then barely used farmland, and they built the house Phil lives in today. It was their escape from the cramped Italian ghetto of Corona. And when Phil graduated college, his dad gave him and his wife the house to start their own family. Phil wanted to be a teacher, a public servant, just like his dad. This is the other industry that built Long Island, public workers. And unlike manufacturing, it's still thriving.
I interviewed for the job in 72, and I later found out the story behind the job. So when I interviewed for the job, the principal of the building was Swedish. And he was not sure about hiring me for whatever reason. I don't know why. but his secretary was Italian. And years later, she told me the story. Her name was Terry, and she said, you know, after you walked out of that interview, he came out of the office and said to me, well, should I hire the little Italian? The little Italian. No. And she said to him, you better.
That's the last bit of anti-Italian bias Phil can recall, because life was good for Italians in the suburbs. In fact, it felt like all of a sudden Italians were running things. You know, Mario Cuomo and all that.
I remember thinking, my God, an Italian governor, that was so foreign to me. You know, Italians just didn't rise to that level, you know. And then things changed. Then, you know, De Niro, Pacino, it became cool to be Italian.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
But the legacy of being in between people remained. That fear of nearness to black people, or farness from full white status, it still shaped life. Phil notes that he was 44 years old before he made friends with a black person.
I felt so sad that it took me 44 years to actually break down that barrier and socialize with people of color. And it's just ignorance. It's just, we are ignorant of each other. And it's sad. It really is. Integration is a wonderful thing. Once you break down those barriers, it's like, oh my God.
Phil is sickened by Donald Trump and his campaign. To him, Trump's fear-mongering of Mexicans and Muslims has played on all the worst parts of America's immigration story.
There's a pecking order in this country. Every new immigrant that enters this country has to start at the bottom, I guess. And in the end, they're going to be very productive citizens. They're going to be very grateful, as Italians are, very grateful that we came to this wonderful country of opportunity. Look at where we are here, right? It's paradise. I thank God every day that my family did what they did and sent me to college and gave me a better life. It's all about a better life.
And that's what the 20th century promised, a better life, at least for white America. And it delivered pretty broadly for Phil's generation, even for those without a college degree. But as you've heard, for the Trump supporters we've met, that promise is gone. And they are particularly concerned about what that means for the next generation. To a lot of people on Long Island, the kids are not all right. And it's not just about jobs and money. It's not even just about white kids. Next week, gangs and drugs.
Our opioid crisis is the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history. The number of people dying of overdoses today is far higher than anything we've ever seen. The CDC has recognized that this is the most urgent public health problem facing the country.
That was episode 5 of the WNYC series, The United States of Anxiety. To hear the first 4 episodes in the series and to make sure you don't miss the next 3, go to iTunes and subscribe to The United States of Anxiety. Thank you. I'm Bob Garfield.
WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. They're one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.